Well, let's get done what we get together to do, and that's study the Word of God verse by verse. We are looking in the book of Numbers right now. We'll get back to the book of Leviticus, the rule book for Levites, in a little bit. But there are some bits and pieces in the book of Numbers that deal with rules and regulations. And chapter number 6 has something to say about vows, a very specific vow. And so I put this here because once we swap back over to Leviticus 27 in a bit, that's going to be about vows. And so I think this vow of the Nazarene should be thought of in connection with those vows that come up in the book of Leviticus. So Numbers chapter 6, verse 1 says, "He who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, this word in Hebrew, Nazir, has to do with something being untrimmed. And so it's kind of a looking at the hair issue for the guys. So they take this vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to he who is. So this vow is for a temporary or lifelong separation from normal lifestyle. And so people can do it on a part-time or a short-time or a lifetime basis. We have some examples where people are put under lifelong Nazarite vows before they're even born. So their moms have to be Nazarites during the time of their pregnancy. I'm thinking about Samuel. I'm thinking about Samson. I think about John the Immerser in the New Testament. These three gentlemen were placed under a lifelong Nazarite vow, and because of that, their moms had to spend the 9 months of their pregnancy under that same vow. More than likely, they also had to be under that vow during the time that they were nursing these children. So that's what Nazarite vows can look like. We've seen them in Scripture. But they can also be temporary. Paul appears to take a Nazarite vow during a couple of his missionary journeys. I suspect that he may have taken it while he was on the journey, and as he was getting ready to head back to the Promised Land, back to Israel, he wrapped up the vow because he was wrapping up his journey. And so that's why we see him getting his hair cut, because that's the way you signal the end of your vow. So back to the procedures involved in this Nazarite vow. Verse 3, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, so no alcoholic beverages whatsoever. The difference between wine and strong drink is basically, I think, wine is specifically from the grape, and strong drink is an alcoholic beverage made from anything else. And sometimes you can really bump up the alcoholic content by the process of fermenting some of these things. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink. If you can't drink wine or strong drink, then you can't drink any vinegar that has been distilled from it. That makes good sense. He shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried. Now, he can eat sweet things that strong drink might be made out of, and he can eat the grain products that strong drink may be made out of, but anything from the vine is totally off limits, regardless of whether it's part of the alcoholic wine or not. So he can't have grape juice. He can't eat grapes fresh. He can't have raisins, obviously, and we're going to see in a moment, he can't even have grape leaves or seeds, nothing from the plant. And this might be tied into why it's called the Nazarite vow. It's the idea of the untrimmed vine, because that's how you refer to the untrimmed vines in the vineyard in the year of the Sabbath and the year of Jubilee. They were untrimmed. They were Nazarene. Verse 4, all the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head. So he is untrimmed, just like an untrimmed vine. All the time, until the time is completed for which he separates himself to he who is, he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair, of his beard, his head, grow long. Now that includes his beard. So if you're a gentleman, it's going to be pretty obvious how long you've been a Nazarite based on how long your beard and your hair is. Samson, he lives as a Nazarite for the 40 years of his life, and he seems to have braided his long hair into 7 braids. That's what gets him into trouble, is when he lets Delilah talk him into getting those things cut. We don't know exactly what Samuel looked like. He seems to have been described in some passages as this wild-looking guy. So maybe he kind of had that Middle Eastern Afro sort of thing going on. I don't know. And he lived a much longer life, so his hair could have gotten pretty long and gray. John the Immerser, he is executed in his 30s, so who knows how he kept his hair. But verse number 6 brings up the third thing that marks a Nazarite. So far we've got no alcoholic beverages, no grape products, so his diet is described. His hair is not to be cut, even his beard. And then verse 6, all the days that he separates himself to he who is, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother, for brother or sister. If they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to he who is. So this is where the Nazarite sounds an awful lot like a priest going through his ordination ceremony, because a priest could not go to the funeral of a family member during his ordination ceremony. He could, after he'd become a priest, he could go to a family member's funeral and touch the body, which is part of the funeral procedure. But for a Nazarite, the entire time of his separation as a Nazarite, could not go to a funeral even of a close member of his family. He had to stay away, which is kind of strange, because we assume that John's aged parents, I'm talking about John the Immerser in the New Testament, probably died while he was a younger man. And so he would not have been able to help in washing and wrapping their bodies for the funeral. He could not have touched their bodies one last time to say goodbye. He would have had to have been at a distance from those bodies as they were taken away to the tomb in his grief. So those are all the things that are associated with being a Nazarite. No alcoholic beverages or grape products. You don't cut your hair, and you don't touch human dead bodies. Actually, you're not supposed to touch any dead bodies in the sense of non-food. So, verse 9 tells us this: if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. On the eighth day he shall bring 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head that same day, and separate himself to he who is for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering, but the previous period shall be void because his separation was defiled. So this is a what if situation. What if he's standing right next to someone who has a heart attack and keels over on him, dead? Well, he's now touched a dead body. It was by accident, but it just terminated his vow. So he has to start all over again. So if he's vowed for a period of time, then he's back to 0 day. And he has to go through this period or this procedure of getting back into the process. The stuff that's described here is to show that it was an accident. He didn't intend for this to happen, and he wants to have a clean slate and start over again with God. Verse 13, this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of their separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. So this is how you wrap up your vow period, if it's not for your life. So this is what we see in the book of Acts. When Paul comes back from his third missionary journey, and James and the other leaders of the church meet with him and say, look, Paul, you're doing a great job with the Gentiles, but we've got this rumor going around that you're telling Jews that they have to quit being Jews, that they have to become Gentiles in order to be saved. And we need to prove that that's not the case. So we know, and I'm guessing this is what they said, we know that you have completed your own Nazarite vow recently, and you're going to be going through the procedures to finish that vow period in the temple. We want you to take several other Jewish believers in Jesus who have finished their Nazarite vows, and you pay for them to go through the procedures in the temple. And that'll prove to everyone that you are still on board with Jews being Jews. And Paul agreed to that. He was not compromising. He was not compromising the faith in Christ. His big deal about the law was very often about the idea you're not saved by this Pharisaic approach to the law, and Gentiles most certainly can't be compelled to live by the law, to proselytize to Judaism. So he's still perfectly fine with Nazarite vows and even does them himself. So you can kind of check on that yourself. But this is the procedure that he and the other gentlemen would have been going through in the temple when he gets accused of bringing Gentiles in there and the riot happens and he gets arrested and spends 4 years waiting to be cleared in the Roman court system of being in the middle of a riot. Verse 13. Again, this is the law of the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. He shall bring his gift to he who is, one male lamb a year old, without blemish for a burnt offering, one ewe lamb a year old, without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without a blemish as a peace offering. And there's no big deal about the fact that Paul and these other guys would have done those actions. They know that all of those things pointed toward Jesus. And so they wouldn't have been thinking that they were gaining sin forgiveness from these sacrifices because Jesus had fulfilled them already. So they're just going through the traditional motions. Verse 15, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers mixed smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. And the priest shall bring them before he who is and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offerings to he who is with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. So shaving the head was part of the procedure of terminating your Nazarite vow. And more than likely, Paul cut his hair once when he was at Cenchrea, the port for Corinth, on his way back to Jerusalem area from his third missionary journey. And so that would have shown he was finishing his Nazirite vow. He probably would have collected the clippings from his haircut and carried them with him the rest of the way to Jerusalem. And then on this day, he may have had his hair cut again. His fellows that were going through him with him in the ceremony would have cut their hair. And the hair clippings would have been given to the priests, and the priest would have burned them up with the sacrifice, just like it is described here in Numbers chapter 6, verse 18. Verse 19, the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it's boiled, and the one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them in the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before he who is. They are the holy portion for the priest, together with the bread that's waved and the thigh that's contributed. And after that, the Nazirite may drink wine. So he pays the priest with the priest portion of the sacrifice. Probably some of the sacrifice was also eaten by the Nazirite. And then this completes his point or her period of Nazirite vow. They can now go back to all the normal things that would be part of a Jewish lifestyle, including partaking of the vine, drinking this wine, eating grape products, being able to go to a funeral of their close family members even, and being able to cut their hair on a regular basis to keep it trimmed up. So that's the point of a Nazirite vow, is it's a voluntary, in most cases, choice to act like a priest in their ordination period. And once you finish whatever it is that you're doing with that vow, then you wrap it up with this sacrifice and you go back to your life as usual in its holiness. There is some confusion for some reason for people, probably just because of the similar sound. Jesus was never under a Nazirite vow. He was from the town of Nazareth, which made him a Nazarene. But don't confuse the two. Jesus' cousin, John, was under a Nazirite vow. But Jesus was not. And just want to help you remember the distinction between those two things regarding Jesus. So this is the law of the Nazirite. If he bows, he vows an offering to the Lord, to he who is above his Nazirite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazirite. So if he's made promises above and beyond his Nazirite vow, this is the time that he should pay those promises off. Let's go over to Leviticus 27 now, because I think we've pulled in what we needed to from the book of Numbers. And continue with some of the more, some of the rule book items for the Levitical priesthood to help Israeli people do things fairly and properly. So we've been talking about vows, so I thought this would be a good time to jump into chapter 27, which also talks about vows. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to he who is involving the valuation of persons." So what is a vow? A vow is a very solemn, serious, and ceremonious promise. So it is done before witnesses and before God. So if anyone's made this special vow that's going to involve people and the value that should be assigned to people, well, here are the standards that were being used in the time of Moses. The valuation of a male from 20 years old up to 60 old will be 50 shekels of silver according to the shekel of the sanctuary. So 20 to 60 is basically the working years, the physical working years of the average male. And so his valuation is going to be the equivalent of 50 shekels. Back at that time, they were using shekels as a weight of silver. Eventually, they coin it and give a value to the coins. And that's why I kind of use this idea of 50 shekels is roughly 100 days' wages. So think about a little bit over 3 months' worth of work. That's what the value is placed here. If the person is a female, the valuation shall be 30 shekels, or basically 60 days' wages. Now, don't get all upset about that, because remember, the difference between a female and a male is one of them is going to be actually out in the physical economy doing a lot of work and heavy lifting and things like that. And so their valuation is going to take in consideration that they are, as we still say to this day, the breadwinner of the family. They're the ones that are actually bringing perhaps some shekels back into the household. It's not devaluing the woman in this situation of this time, other than they typically did not work in the economy of this particular culture period. And remember, these valuations are from the time of Moses. They probably would have been adjusted over the Jewish history period. Verse number 5, if the person is from 5 years of old up to 20 years old, his valuation shall be for a male 20 shekels, for a female 10 shekels. So kids, and whether or not they can be doing work out in the economy, that has something to do with it as well. And the valuation is usually just take the shekel times 2, and that'll tell you the day's wages more than likely. If the person is from a month old up to 5 years old, the valuation shall be for a male 5 shekels, for a female 3 shekels. A person is 60 years or older, then the valuation for the male would be 15 shekels, for the female 10 shekels. If someone is too poor to pay the valuation, then he shall be made to stand before the priest, and the priest shall value him. The priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. Now, this is where we get to the point of the valuation. If you are making a special vow to give a special gift to God, then that gift is based on your ability to give. And that is going to be based on where you're at in the economy situation. So if you're a guy working on a regular basis out there, then you're the one that should be able to give the most. And so you're expected to give the most. But if you're like an older retired lady, then you shouldn't have to give very much because you can only give so much. And if you're totally out of work, then the priest is going to interview you, talk to you, and tell you what they think you could probably give in order to make this vow of special worship. All right, verse 9. If the vow is an animal that may be offered as an offering to he who is, all of it that he gives to he who is holy. This is the idea. I like to use this example. You've got a pregnant cow, and it's not the first baby that this cow has had because you had to give that one to the Lord anyway. But you've got a pregnant cow, and you want to give the baby to God as a special gift. So you make that vow. Verse 10, he shall not exchange it or make a substitute for it, good or bad, good for bad or bad for good. If he does, in fact, substitute one animal for another, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. So the baby's born, the baby cow is born, and you just give it to God. So that's the normal procedure because you promised to give it to God. Well, what if the baby is born and you're like, oh, that's not good enough? That's not a good enough offering for God. You can't substitute another animal in the place of that and keep that animal. If you want to substitute a better animal, then you give both the original animal you vowed plus the substitute. And that's the idea that once you make a vow to God, you keep it. You follow through with it, which is why in the New Testament, there is conversations coming from Jesus and also from Jesus' half-brother James that when you make vows, you just follow through with it. And that's why it's better to not vow at all. Because your yes should mean yes and your no should be no. You shouldn't have to reinforce it by making vows to God. Because you always keep your word. Christians should be people of their word. Well, I see we've run out of time again for today and for this week, and we're not done yet with this section on vows. So have a great weekend, and we'll get back together in the Word on Monday.